G'day, I'm Willie Miller.
Hi, I'm Seth Coe.
I'm Peter Mackin.
Hello, I'm Jonathan Mackin.
Hi, it's Grant Hackett here.
Hi, I'm Cheryl Spence from the Wallaroos.
I'm Azuma Nelson.
I'm Gashirin, and you're listening to Not the Footish.
Yes, you are indeed listening to another podcast of Not the Footy Show. And as we do on every show, we've got another great guest lined up for you today. And we're going to be talking sports television and how so many sports are looking for the OTT option, which is the over-the-top version. And John Nienaber, who's the general manager and executive producer at Astro Arena, will be going through all of that with us. But we should state now that his views are his own and not those of the station. Anyway, I'm Ashley Morrison.
I'm John Lee.
John, good to be back.
Big disclaimer there to start the show.
Well, that's very important because obviously he's got his opinions and they are his opinions and not those of his station. And so it's very important that we make sure everybody is aware of that. But it's great to be back in front of you again. I know we were last time, but it's great that sport here in Perth, Western Australia as well looks like it's coming back as well. I've missed it.
Guess what I did on Saturday?
You ran.
I played,
with a stick.
I played in a scratch match.
Oh, right.
Played real hockey with actual tackling in it, which was quite funny because under the rules and regulations we have at the moment, pre and post game, still the social distancing 1.5 and all that sort of stuff. During the game, no problems. Run along next to that person that's going. There's something wrong with these rules somewhere. If it's okay for me to be running around with some person heavily breathing on me, I don't understand why we still have these 1.5 metres. Anyway, I'm liking it though because I get to play.
That's the main thing. Now, I believe you're going to start us off today.
I am. Well, while we're on the coronavirus sort of angle, something I've noticed in the last few weeks, with the return of some sports, no crowds. We've seen it in Germany and trying to fix things up and putting fake people in the stands.
And the Korean team that put the blow up dolls, which upset everybody.
Yeah. Oh, well, credit for having a crack.
Yeah, I could imagine it.
I mean, yeah. I mean, I get it, but it just didn't work out for them, did it? But I think that there's a realization, I think, starting to, happen in sport and amongst some sports administrators that maybe all the fans they have aren't really fans. Maybe all of those people they thought were in love with their sport aren't really in love with their sport. And one thing I've been noticing, especially in talkback radio, is the number of people ringing up saying, oh, I don't like it, I'm not going to watch it because there's not the crowd there. What were you watching in the first place? Were you tuned into the crowd or were you tuned into the game?
Well, it's funny because John will actually deal with that in our conversation there because one of the things is definitely, as we all know, a crowd makes an atmosphere. I've got to say when I'm commentating, a great crowd can really lift you as a commentator because you get caught up in it as well. And I'm sure the players do it, that it lifts them, their intensity goes. So I think those fans that are making that saying, or they don't like it, making that comment, I agree with them. I find it very hard to watch.
See, my personal opinion on these sorts of things is, there's certain sports that I don't like, and I don't care if I'm in a stadium of 100,000 people cheering madly or whether I'm sitting there by myself. I don't like watching it. Now, so I don't watch those sports. The other side is the sport that I do play and I do enjoy watching, hockey, never has crowds anyway. So the idea of watching a sporting contest without a big crowd cheering me on to get me excited doesn't necessarily bother me. But what sports administrators are finding out is there's a lot of people out there that aren't actually fans of the game. They're fans of the occasion.
Absolutely. Now, I mean, that's been around, I think, for a while. I'm like you. I'll go and watch local football. Yeah. There'll be 75 people there. I've gone to watch cricket where there's been a couple of hundred in a big basin, you know. And so, yeah, I'm with you. If I want to watch it or there's a player playing, I'll go and watch it. And usually it's just being with your friends, enjoying the spectacle and watching a sport you love. But I think you're right there, John, that there's a lot of people are there for the occasion. We've seen it here in Western Australia when grand finals have been held here in football and all these people have gone that have never gone to a game of football in their life, but they want to be part of the occasion.
Yeah, and that happens a lot in Perth because we've starved a lot of what we might term big events. And so people just want to go out to a big event. They're not really interested in what that event necessarily may or may not be. If you're a sports administrator, are you getting a bit toey about how many of these people are actually going to drop off altogether now? because we've had this break and these people have suddenly come to realise that, well, am I really that enamoured with the sport? Are people now, because they've, that cycle of tuning in every season has been broken, they've gone off and they've found other things to do. Are they going to be coming back to the sport? Are we going to get the viewing figures again that we used to? Or are people now saying, oh, actually, I didn't really like football that much?
I think there's a question I've got for you here, because we've talked about this before. And if you look at it, we know that the trend today in people a lot younger than us is that they don't support a team. They support a player, in that they have their favourite player and they will watch that player. And when that player changes club, they move to the club that the player moves to, and their loyalty to the former club is no longer there. So we've lost that club loyalty. So do you think that is also one of the major reasons that we're seeing this, is that there's no affinity to those clubs anyway? And I've asked this question on my blog, notthefootyshow.com, is how many clubs actually now stand for something? So, you know, when I was growing up in England, where you've got football clubs, you know, all around the country, they are a reflection on that community. And if you look at in the sport we don't mention, a lot of the clubs in Victoria, again, are a sort of representation of that community and that pocket of Melbourne. And I just think some of the newer clubs in our competitions don't reflect us as people or as a community.
No, that's true. I'd agree with you there. I wonder how much it'll change the landscape for, I don't think for television viewers, but for actual game day attendances, for those rusted on fans. I think that the days of rusted on fans are definitely numbered. You're still going to get them, but
the entry fee is going to have to come down.
Well, possibly. Obviously TV rights deals are going to have to come down. I mean, that's a no-brainer. I'm sure John's going to talk about that anyway during his interview, but we all know that's coming. That sport has been overpaid. There was a rush to get everything signed up. And probably if you're a sport that missed that rush in the last 10 or 15 years, it ain't coming for you. You're sliding back down the pile. If these guys are sliding down, you're going to be sliding too.
Yeah, I think we've seen some chief executives where their egos of wanting to be the big boy on the block that landed that sport, they got a bit too caught up in that and bid more money than they should have. And certainly they're going to get a rap across the knuckles now when their money isn't there, and they're going to have to be more accountable.
And we've often talked about this idea of sport and business. Is sport a business? Is it not? Where's its place, etc.? If it's a business, these things come in cycles, etc., etc. Nothing lasts forever. So where are we at the nothing lasts forever time frame for sport? Given that sport, as we know it, as organised sport, really didn't kick off until the second half of the 19th century, in the early days. I mean, before that, yes, there was sport, there was activities, and yes, you could argue that there was organised sport such as horse racing, and there were competitions and boxing and all those sorts of things. But organised community sport didn't really start until the second half of the 19th century. So we're only 150 years max into that cycle of organised community sport. Now, as the communities fragment, which we are undoubtedly doing, we're being broken down into our individual consumers, what is the role of sport in that? And does it have a place? Or is it all going to be about, you know, individual sports and adventure sports and things like that? Are people, has society moved past that model of a community-based sporting organisation?
That's a very good question. I don't think I've got time to answer it. I mean, I do agree with you to a certain extent. I think at a smaller level, I think there is still a very much a place for community clubs. So where little Johnny can go down and play with his mates, and then dad can play, say, in an amateur team on a Sundays. I think those clubs very much so. I do think the professional clubs are going to have to lift their game. As we've said before, I don't think a sports management degree is necessarily the qualification for you to run a sporting organisation successfully. I think you're going to need people who've worked in the real business world, who know how business works, to actually come in and have an influence there.
And it has to be tempered by people who know how sport works.
Absolutely. Yeah.
So you've got to have that
dichotomy. Yeah, it's like an executive board, isn't it? You want the skill set that covers all the eventualities within your organisation. And I think that's going to be very important. And I think they also have to realize, as we just touched on, what their club stands for. What do they want it to be? Is it a community club? What are the sort of values that they have as a club? Because that's the only way I think we're going to see the people tap into it. If you're just a standalone club and you're just playing a sport, people are not going to connect with you. 100% I agree with you. And yeah. I think that's where they will move away to those individual events. And I think it's a shame in a way that the Tokyo Olympic Games are not happening, because rock climbing, which I was like, how is this going to work at the Olympics? Having seen it at the Asian Games, it is fantastic. It is great TV viewing. It's a great sport. The athleticism of the people is fantastic. I think that is something that's going to really take off, because I saw it, loved it.
Well, it's interesting the way that the Guinness Book of Records breaks these things up. And I think I've got a copy over there somewhere. I have, and I can't see it. But the Guinness Book of Records calls it sports, games,
pastimes. Yep.
Okay. And when you think about it, in the history and the growth and development of organized sport, the idea of sport is only a 20th century thing. I mean, it was previous to this, the 20th century, even though it was organized community sport, it was a pastime. It was a hobby. It was something you did like flower arranging in your spare time. It wasn't the be all and end all of a career or anything like that. You would work 6 days. Then on the seventh day, you'd go off and you'd play your game of rugby or play whatever you want. But it was pastime, hobby. It wasn't business. And when you try and transfer that into a business world, that's why we're getting muddled.
And also now, if you look, and it's perfect segue into our interview, is it sport or is it entertainment when it comes to television?
Hi, it's Grant Hackett here. You're listening to Not The Footy Show.
Yes, you're indeed listening to the podcast of Not The Footy Show. And it's time for our special guest on this podcast. And I'm very pleased to say that he has over 35 years experience in the television world, having worked for television stations in Australia, for Sky Sports, having worked on their cricket in the UK, and is now the general manager and executive producer of Astro Arena in Malaysia. We've had him on the show before, but we're very pleased to welcome back to the show John Nienaber. John Nienaber, welcome back to Not The Footy Show.
Thank you, Ashley. Very happy to be talking to you again.
It is indeed. Well, we thought we'd catch up with you because obviously with 35 years of broadcast experience, you'd be pretty clued up on the way things are going in the broadcast world. And I mean, one of the first questions, I suppose, is are we going to see massive changes after this COVID-19 pandemic?
I think we'll see some changes, Ash. It will be more in terms of, I think, second, third tier sport than the top tier events. You know, as we've seen most recently, you know, the NRL in Australia and AFL and so on, the EPL, they've all managed to maintain their position, albeit with slightly reduced rights in the case of the NRL, with the Nine Network and also Fox Sports there. But what would concern me more is the inability for the second and third tier sport to gain any traction. And I'm pretty sure that what we're going to see is we're going to see an evolution that will move along a pathway where less and less of them actually end up on either free-to-air or pay platforms. It'll be more OTT type of events. And we saw that, I guess, prior to COVID-19. I just think we'd probably see it accelerate afterwards.
So one of the key things I would imagine is that you're going to see those tier one sports like you mentioned, the EPL, the NRL, the funding that comes from television, I would imagine, would drop. And that's why you're saying that the sort of second tier and third tier sports are probably not going to get a slice of the pie anymore.
Yeah, that's a pretty good summary of what I was trying to define as what, how I see it going forward. The reduction, while it hasn't been really significant, where we've gone, we've seen the total deal for rights for NRL, you know, contract by maybe $300 million over 7 years now. I did note today that the AFL is yet to conclude a rights arrangement with the broadcasters for the remainder of this season. I'll be interested to see how that turns out and what ends up landing on the table in terms of, in fact, what the reductions will be. I've also noted that the first match to have spectators will be on Saturday, the showdown between Adelaide and Port Adelaide. So that's a plus for them because, you know, broadcasters look at these properties and say, well, what makes the product so good? And as you know, and everybody that's listening to your podcast knows, that mostly the atmosphere adds so much to a sporting event. So you take the spectators out and you pretty much got a flat experience. So broadcasters are looking to extract some wins from that by saying, well, not only are you not or haven't been playing matches, so therefore there's no matches, there's no rights, but when you do recommence, if there's no spectators, through no fault of your own, but we want to renegotiate the number and where we're going to land because that's an integral part of the experience for a consumer. And, you know, we've all got to admit that sport is entertainment, so it's actually up against lots of other entertainment genre as well, isn't it? You know, looking for an audience share. But that's an important part. And when you also separate Tier 1, Tier 2, Tier 3, you'll note that there are different participation levels in terms of what spectator interests and consumer interests and where they lie. And without those numbers, you do have a significant reduction in the atmosphere. And consequently, that becomes a factor in the rights arrangements.
No, I can totally agree with you there. As a commentator, you feed off the atmosphere inside a ground as well. And I mean, if you look, John, there's a lot of the big sort of sporting clubs like a Manchester United and an Arsenal, they've formed their own TV stations. Do you think they're going to be affected or they've got everything in place now and they may actually become stronger because of what where we're at the moment?
Well, yes, they could in fact become stronger. Absolutely. Those sorts of teams, they've developed critical mass and they've got on the ground floor, so to speak, and then the market's kind of evolved around them. The hard part these days is for, you know, a sporting organisation, and, you know, I dare say it, a classic example for me would be hockey. And, you know, now hockey is a terrific sport, no denying that, but it doesn't have the same sort of appeal that some of those other sports are having. And, you know, when you try and start generating an audience from a standing start and attempting to deliver it via OTT and therefore circumventing orthodox broadcasters, it's a pretty hard thing to do to be able to build an audience around that, notwithstanding your lack of resource to actually cover the matches at such a level that a Man United v Chelsea match would attract in terms of broadcast facilities, resources, the critical mass audience that is attracted to it, notwithstanding free-to-air and pay TV and their interest in what they pay in rights. One has to be very careful, though, if you're a governing body of a sport, federation, is another way to put it, is that you don't alienate and compete head-to-head with your broadcasters and therefore, you know, the customer being the bigger broadcasters finding themselves in a situation where they're cornered by your own actions. It's a really fine line that you have to walk between the two and knowing which one is more important than the other. So, you know, that's the way that these things are looked at in the broader sense internationally.
Now, you mentioned this OTT platform, and we've got the sort of former Australian footballers, soccer players, they're talking about trying to have FFA TV and taking the A-League to that. You mentioned the FIH there. What exactly is OTT for people that don't know? I mean, it's over-the-top platform, but how does it work, and has it got a future, or is it, do you think, just a fad?
No, I think it's got a future. Just coming back to the definition, yes, you're absolutely right, over the top. It was a phrase that was coined originally because what it did was allow a sporting organisation, for example, to bypass traditional media and go directly to the consumer. And, you know, in a lot of cases, it actually was a plus. And, you know, the United States market is a classic example of that. The bigger markets like Europe and so on, like we've already talked about. The ones that struggle are the smaller ones. And, you know, you've got to find a critical mass. And if you haven't got a critical mass, it's very difficult to make it work and deliver content at the same level that a consumer expects. You know, I mean, if I'm a soccer fan, and I'm watching an EPL match, and it's delivered in the best image possible. And you know, these days it's normally 4K, and it's HDR, which is high dynamic range 4K, not standard dynamic range. And you put that up against an organisation, and in this case, using your example, FFA, if they haven't got the means or the resources, then, you know, it's going to fall short in the eyes of the consumer. But the consumer expectation is still, it doesn't change. It's still looking to be able to experience at the highest possible level. And the difficulty is with organisations who don't realise how difficult it is to actually create the content to feed the beast if you're running your own channel. It's pretty hard to understand that unless you've been on the other side. In other words, on the inside of an organisation that is a dedicated sports broadcaster, and the lengths that they go to create content to feed the beast, which is to keep the content in front of the consumer, market it to the consumer, produce the live content, but also advertise that live content by creating other shows around it. It's a constant battle between the cost of production per hour, the quality that you're trying to produce it at in terms of the production value, the image quality, and all those other sorts of things, and the cost of resource. You know, the question is, do you own it yourself? Probably not, unless you're a broadcaster. And lots of broadcasters, as you know, don't own their own equipment these days. You know, Australia is a classic example again, where facilities companies rent their equipment to broadcasters, and broadcasters have the critical mass to be able to pay for it. Does FFA have that critical mass? I think it's starting from a much, much lower base. It doesn't have the cash. It doesn't have a balance sheet like the AFL has, or even now the NRL. And if we look at, for examples, between AFL, NRL, FFA, you will note, and your listeners would note, that the AFL balance sheet, while it was quite strong, they still had to go and borrow in excess of $600 million to get through this period, even though they were such a strong brand in Australia. Now, if you're FFA, they've had to go through the same period. They've had to struggle with a lack of revenue. How are they going to be able to achieve it unless they've got some pretty cashed up backers? My question would be, where do those backers come from? Now, you know, like I said a little while ago, a club like Chelsea or Man United or someone, Man City, someone like that, Arsenal, Liverpool, you know, they've had that critical mass over a long, long period of time, and it's a global phenomenon. You know, in Southeast Asia, you would know that Liverpool has a huge following in Southeast Asia. You know, what club in, you know, that plays under the FFA banner has that sort of following outside of Australia? Pretty much zero, I would think. So, you know, you've got a much smaller market. You've got to generate enough revenue. You've got to seek that critical mass. Where does it come from? Unless you start really, really small, and then you're competing with the big guys. That's the hard part.
Yeah, I mean, I agree 100% with what you're saying, because those are the concerns I have. And we spoke to David Mitchell, who's an expert in branding, and he was saying in our podcast number 58 that if you take those examples that you used, Arsenal, Man U, TV, he was saying, for example, on their apps and all of that, they've got staff trained to react to social media comment so that it all comes through in the same voice and the same terminology, so that it looks like it's one person reacting. So they've invested a fortune, exactly as you were touching on there, to ensure that their brand and the quality is kept at a set level. And I just worry some of these second-tier sports, whether they have the money or the resources to be able to do that.
I wouldn't think so. To be absolutely honest, to be brutally honest, I wouldn't think so. It takes a really dedicated team to be able to you know, keep abreast of all those sorts of things, and you've got to have people. Now, you know, unless you've got the people, and as we've seen before, whether you're a sporting organisation or your coal supermarket, if social media, you get on the wrong side of that, and you don't have the means to mediate, moderate, to put out, and as you quite rightly say, to speak with one voice, and have a consistency of messaging, then you're pretty much toast. It doesn't take much to upset people these days. And with the instant reactions that you do get from social media, you absolutely have to have a team in place to be able to mitigate the downside. And, you know, that can come at you pretty rapidly. So, you know, I would agree, and, you know, these sorts of things aren't all about fierce agreement, but certainly common sense would dictate to me that it's a very difficult thing to create your own OTT channel, moderate the channel via social media and so on, market it, get the messaging consistent, and then produce the matches at such a high level that you can compete head-to-head with the other sports that already have that critical mass, notwithstanding the amount of statistical data that needs to also be incorporated in what you're trying to convey to the consumer. Because, let's face it, I mean, consumers expect this today, and it doesn't come cheap.
No, it doesn't. I mean, and you're absolutely right with the marketing, because I spoke to someone else on that sort of vein, and they were saying, you know, if you go away from mainstream or subscription television onto an OTT platform, your sort of dedicated fans will find you, but those who are new to the sport won't. And they were saying that you probably need a blend of the two, the sort of traditional TV or subscriber TV and OTT games, maybe your lesser tournaments or whatever on the OTT platform. But do you agree with that, or do you think, you know, you've really got to leap one way or the other?
No, I think that those organisations that have the ability to, you know, to straddle the marketing, the one voice, the social media, and also are a traditional orthodox broadcaster, have a means to be able to do it, as opposed to someone that's just, you know, it's a standing start. Notwithstanding what I've said about and what we've discussed about Chelsea and TV and Man United and Arsenal, Liverpool, etc. You know, those organisations are strong, but it's really, really hard to start these days from nothing. Now, you know, people will argue against it and say, oh, no, that's not true, you know. Look at these successful YouTube channels and so on. Well, yeah, okay, yeah, I mean, yeah, we can agree with that to some extent. But if you actually look at what sport is solely exposed via YouTube or solely exposed via an app, their own standalone app, well, you know, if we talk about the latter, which is the standalone app, the cost to produce a very, very good app, it doesn't get much below 300,000 euro. Significant sum to make. Then you have to maintain the app. You don't just make it and forget it.
Yeah.
You've got a thing called CDN, which is the content distribution network costs. And people will say, once again, who are aware of this, oh, well, you know, it's the consumer that pays for the delivery. Well, yeah, well, the consumer pays for the delivery that's pushed to them because, you know, you're paying for your data with your telco plan or whatever it might be. But for the content producer or provider, you also have to get it to the cloud. And then there is a cost involved. And it's a cost that you pay a certain amount for per thousand. Forecast consumers. And if you forecast too high, you pay too much. If you forecast too low, you pay significantly more than your base rate. And an example of that would be Optus and the last World Cup.
Yeah.
Where they underestimated by a massive amount how many people would go to download the app and then access it simultaneously. So you've got all those sorts of things that need to be considered. Not just, oh, I'm going to create an app and I'm going to do this and then it's just going to all fall in my lap. I'm not saying it can't be done. I'm just saying there are many, many more challenges to getting it done than what people consider when they first have a look at it.
Now, that's great, John, to catch up and get your views on that. And we should stress they are your personal views and not those of the TV station you work for in Malaysia. But just one last question. It sounds to me as if you think there are some sports or some clubs that are going to benefit in the future from this OTT platform, whereas there are some that are going to come unstuck with it.
Yeah, I would agree with that. I think that there's a niche market where, and I'm talking about niche markets for certain sports. You mentioned earlier that those that are rustling on fans, they'll find you, and yes, they will find you. But you have to do it very, very sensibly from a cost-benefit type of approach, which is, can I produce the content? Am I able to market the content? Can I moderate it via social media for a certain cost, and therefore the costs that are imposed upon me to be able to do that, I can maintain a revenue stream where I either break even or make a profit. And let's face it, profit shouldn't be a dirty word. We're all in it to make a profit, but you have to be sensible about how you go about it and how much money that you want to spend creating the content for the return, and then you just let it grow organically with the goal in mind that you're trying to attract bigger audiences, and then, you know, it grows naturally. But to step off into the abyss with this idea that, you know, oh, I'm going to take on AFL, or I'm going to replicate Chelsea TV, or even, you know, Sky sports coverage of BPL or BT Sport in the UK or Fox Sports. You know, that they're a lot of money. They're significant sums of money to go out and cover with orthodox broadcast equipment. Now, you know, we are seeing changes in the industry with facilities, where the facilities, the lower cost facilities, are certainly getting better. But the beauty of sports coverage at the highest end is the ability to bring the action home to the viewer. And particularly if you're watching on a small screen, you want to see the action in close-up. and you want to see it in high speed, slow motion, that, what I mean by that is it's shot at high frame rates, and then when it's replayed in slow-mo, it's super slow. You know, if you're doing that, then you have to pay a lot of money for the coverage, because the lenses alone that you know that we would attach to the front of a camera, you know, you don't get one for much less than $100,000 a piece. Now, you know, not too many organisations can afford that in the numbers that you see deployed for high-end sport. So therefore, if you're going to cover it with lower quality equipment or less expensive equipment, then you will see the difference. Absolutely see the difference. Now, some sports, as you know, are better suited to in-your-face type of coverage because you're closer to the action. An example of that would be soccer, where the pitches are traditionally, you know, much smaller than an AFL ground. You know, I mean, MCG as opposed to, you know, somewhere like, you know, traditionally built for purpose soccer venue, Old Trafford or somewhere like that. You can then use different types of equipment, but even then, you're still bringing it home and you're bringing it close to the viewer. And you can only do it by spending the sums of money you need to on the facilities that you deploy to make the coverage the best you possibly can. Now, I'm not saying it can't be done. What I'm saying is that the discerning viewer will notice the difference.
No, absolutely. Well, look, John, we've got to probably run out of time today, but wonderful to catch up with you and get your views on this, because I think it's a topic that a lot of people are talking about but maybe don't understand. So thanks again for your time.
My pleasure, actually. Very, very happy to join you.
Hi, I'm Zocco Kallitz, and you're listening to Not the Footy Show.
Yes, you are indeed listening to Not the Footy Show, and that was John Nienaber, the General Managing Executive Producer of Astro Arena, but we should state categorically that the views that he expressed in that interview are his own and not those of the television station. But John, I mean, some interesting things there in regards to this over-the-top option that people are going for, so which is obviously trying to put out sport over the internet and via apps, etc. And as he's saying in that interview, there's so much more to it than just popping a game up. You've got to feed the beast. And unless you have that critical mass of fans out there, and we've just talked about fans and whether they are there, you're going to struggle. It needs to be, you've already established that platform, and you need to have the money and the expertise to put out quality.
Oh, definitely. I mean, it's all about the quality of your broadcast, whichever distribution platform you choose to put it out on. And of course, each platform has its own pitfalls and its own advantages and et cetera, et cetera. But the core of whatever you do is about your production and the values that you put into your production.
I mean, I go back to the podcast number 65 when we had Sam Goodwin in, who, remember, was talking about the marketing of sport. Yeah. And he was saying what you have to realize again in the sports world, that if you're in the tier one sports, he goes, usually you've got your best marketing people, your best public relations people, your best media people, because they're attracted to the best sports and the best clubs within those sports or whatever. Yeah. And again, so the further down you go, I think the worrying thing for me is for any sport or club that's looking to get in that space is, do you have the right people there? And if you don't, then you're going to struggle. And I think you're also going to need to maybe look at partnering with somebody else who can assist you, because you do not have those skills within your company or organization.
Yeah, definitely. Well, that works in all sorts of business, doesn't it? That hierarchy of the biggest companies are going to pay the most. They're going to have the best lawyers, usually.
They are. But I mean, again, there's so many companies think they can do it.
Well, we're in a funny transition phase, aren't we, between traditional media and the new media. And let's face it, new traditional media is not that old. I mean, say, since the Second World War, new media's been around.
Yep, just after, I would have said,
And certainly...
50s, really.
Once Sputnik goes up, that's when media really changes, because suddenly you've got satellites and you're able to broadcast live sport from anywhere in the world to any other place and all those sorts of things. So it's not that old in itself, the old media, in the sports world, if you know what I mean.
No, and I mean, context. I look in my lifetime how sports broadcasting has just gone from strength to strength. Yeah. I mean, I remember when instant replay came in and we were like, wow, this is amazing. Yeah, you know, and it would come up and you look at the replays we get now and the amount of camera angles we get. And it's just phenomenal how far it's evolved.
And gone are the days where you could leave a camera on the shot of a dog defecating behind a sight screen for minutes on end, just listening to commentators laugh at said dog.
Yeah, and have Richie Benninger, yes, oh, that's a good dismissal.
But it has moved a long way from those days. Look it up on YouTube, folks. It's a classic.
Oh, there's plenty of those. I remember the pig running around the MCG with both of his name on one side and Eddie Hemmings on the other.
Oh, yes. That's the cricket one, yes. Yep. The Australian football story about pigs on the SCG. But I think sport has to be wary of how it spends its money, but it has to understand that you have to spend money, and you're going to have to spend money to make money, which almost means essentially we're going to have to go into debt, inverted commas, to make this work.
Yeah, I think you've got to have a business plan where you sort of, at least as long as you're making money, say in 3 years, you're breaking even in two or whatever.
When you set these things up and start them out, you're going to be making losses before you're going to make any income out of it. So you've got to, that's got to be budgeted in and understanding that, okay, so first year in, we made X loss, second year in, oh yeah, we made a loss again, but we know where we're going with this. And if we get down that line, this is where it's going to end up. And I think sometimes sports go, oh, went broke in the first year. What are we going to do? Well, you didn't invest enough resources in it to start with. And that's classic case of hockey. I mean, when they cut the two commentators back to one commentator for last year's Pro League, everybody hated it. People turned off because of it. And if you don't invest, you'll get nothing in return.
Well, as John said, you got to remember we're all in it to make money, but at the same time we're there to deliver a product.
And there we come back to this sport versus business argument. Is sport there to make money? I would argue it's not there to make money.
Yep, but the top clubs will tell you otherwise. Well, is it turn for me now?
Go on, you have your say.
Okay, mine is something I've raised a long, long time ago. You know, it's been
about wearing a tie and a suit to a presentation, is it?
No, it's not. Okay. No.
I know you've been along.
Yeah, that one was my Ben Buckley bit. Yeah, he did wear a tie the next year though, after I wrote to him, so I did get a victory on that one. No, having played as a goalkeeper in football, I've always been really annoyed how we have all these awards now in sport, and goalkeepers seem to just be discounted when it comes to a player of the year. So to give you an idea, at the World Cup, the Ballon d'Or, which is awarded to the best player, there's only ever been one goalkeeper ever win it in a football World Cup, and that was Oliver Kahn of Germany.
How many World Cups have there been?
Since 1930, every 4 years, so there's been quite a few. If you then look, Lev Yashin won the award in 1963 as one of the top sort of European players. In Africa, you've only had two goalkeepers. Thomas Nkono of Cameroon and Izaki Badu of Morocco won the African Footballer of the Year. Gianluigi Buffon is the only shot stopper to have laid hands on the UEFA Club Footballer of the Year award. If we go into the Football Writers Player of the Year, which started, John, 1947-48, so 73 years, there's only been Bert Trautman, Gordon Banks, Pat Jennings, so one every 18 years, and no one has won it since 84-85. Now, just quickly before I finish, if we look at it in hockey, which is, you know, the sport you're passionate about, Maddy Hinch, to me, 2016, she should have been, in my opinion, and I was asked to put forward my recommendations for the FIH Player of the Year Awards then, and I put her forward for a Player of the Year. She won the Goalkeeper of the Year, had a fantastic tournament at the Olympics, won the gold medal. To me, she was the key factor in Great Britain winning the gold medal. And yet we were told, oh, no, she's a goalkeeper, she's got her own award. So what? She can win that, but why can't she win the best player in the world, you know, in that year? And if you look at it, since 2000 to the present day, the Dutch and Argentinians actually, and the women, only two other women have actually ever won the FIH Women's Player of the Year award. And the Goalkeeper of the Year didn't start until 2014, whereas the Player of the Year started in 1998. So,
well, it's interesting because they have a Player of the Year and then they have a Youth Player of the Year, and you can certainly win both there in the same
exactly.
year.
Yeah, exactly.
So
point.
The idea that they're a Goalkeeper of the Year, oh, well, they've got that award, that goes out the window.
Yeah, so I just think it's wrong. And if you look even in Western Australia, so they had their Football Player of the Year award started in 1961, and there's not been a single goalkeeper. They did create in 1992 the Goalkeeper of the Year award, but not a single goalkeeper's won it here in Western Australia. Why not? There must have been years where, like with Maddie Hinch and like with Oliver Kahn at the World Cup, they were the outstanding player and deserved that accolade.
See, I'd like to see that broken down by who won and positions played in any given year. And I think
I've actually done that once.
Have you?
Yeah, and in football, it tends to be forwards or defenders, rarely midfielders, which is interesting.
Yeah, and in other sports, it tends to be only midfields and forwards and backs don't get into it. It's an interesting question because you'd think, okay, say in a football or a hockey team, there's 11 players on the field. You'd think that possibly once every 11 or 12 years a goalie's going to win it, given that there's 11 players on a field. So I don't – is it right that they get a separate award?
No, I don't think so. I think, you know, why do you need the separate award? They're part of the team.
They are a bit different.
Oh, very different. There's no doubt about that. But you know, I just think they are part of the team. And if you look in a football context now, their role has changed so much. There have been more rule changes for the goalkeeper than any other position in football. So they've had to now adapt phenomenally. It's no longer you can just put the fat kid in goal because he's still got to play with his feet. He's got to catch. He's got to be mobile. He's got to also play as a defender. So
is that how you recruited?
No, I was the smallest. And it's funny, you know what? You know how I ended up in goal? I could not, till we interviewed Dennis Law on this show.
Yeah.
And it was Dennis Law, the great Scottish and Manchester United, also Man City player. And he was saying in his autobiography how when he was a kid, he went in goal. And it was because when we played up on the park, the goal would be four times the size of your goalkeeper lying on the ground. That's where the jumpers went. And so when you wanted to put the small kid in goal, so the opposition had a smaller goal to aim for. So that was, when I read that, I'm like, oh, that's why I went in goal. Because I was always the smallest when we played up on the park. So it's like, you're in goal, and they'd lie me down on the ground and measure me out four times, and that would be where the jumpers went.
Oh, that's brilliant. That's very good. I never knew that about football. That was the park rule?
Well, that was the park rule where I came from, and that's how I ended up in goal, but I'd forgotten completely how I ended up there.
Oh, that's very good. That's very good. Oh, look, goalkeepers, do they deserve a separate award? You know what? I think they probably do deserve a separate award.
But should that discount them from the overall award?
No, it should not. And in fact, what they should probably do is have a forwards, a midfielders, and a... But the way hockey is played now and football, those positions don't exist the way that they used to exist.
Yeah.
The goalie's the only constant in the positional thing. You know, guys that used to be fullbacks are now central defenders, or they're deep defenders, or they give them some other stupid name. They rotate up and down the field. It's not the same traditional positions we used to play, whereas goalies are.
And if you look, John, they used to do it. The FIH used to pick a team of the year, so they would have players in all those positions. Also, FIFA does pick a team of the year at the World Cup usually. I think they still do.
Yeah.
Certainly, a lot of the leagues around the world do that, and it's voted usually by the players as to what players will play in those positions. So that is still there, although there's not an out-and-out midfielder of the year award or an out-and-out... Well, I suppose there is an out-and-out forward because he's usually the top goal scorer.
Yeah, and also, I think you're getting to a stage where the guy who is the best, say, left half back in your nation doesn't necessarily get into your national team because of things like tube balance and, oh, we get more,
doesn't have a good enough engine.
Well, that's,
what a load of rubbish. I know, I get annoyed with that. Shit.
It's more to do with, oh, they're not, they don't have enough strings to their bow, you know. They can only play left half. Yeah, but they're the best damn left half in the country. But they're not going to get picked anymore. The nature of what sort of athletes get chosen for these teams has changed.
That's the business of sport, John.
Oh, business again.
So, people are on the fence. They think it's all over.
See ya. We'll be back next week.